Now, more of Rough and Justice, the story of the 1976 New England Patriots on 98.5, The Sports Hub.
You know, we knew that we were good, and we didn't really pay that much attention to, you know, the fans as far as coming to the games, as far as being a sellout or not. Obviously, we loved our fans who were there at the games, and they supported us very, very well. But it was a little bit strange because at that time, the Bruins were, you know, pretty good team. They were. I think they had won the Stanley Cup the year before, or right along that time, whatever. But I know Boston had Havlicek and those guys still there, and Dave Cowens. They still have some legends there. You know, it was a deal where I guess the Patriots at that time didn't have any legendary players like the Celtics and the Bruins and the Red Sox. And so it wasn't a thing that I think a lot of our players thought about as far as being fourth on the list.
Capturing the attention of the Boston sports audience wasn't easy for Ray Hamilton and the Patriots in 1976. Remember the NFL TV blackout rule? It hasn't been invoked in years, but in the 70s, it was a way of life in Foxborough. Only Billy Sullivan's relenting to pressure from Congress allowed the Raiders game to be shown in the Boston market. It was the third straight home game that failed to sell out. John Hanna had played his college ball in front of much bigger crowds at Alabama.
I mean, it was just a small rinky-dink stadium. And I can remember we played the Giants in the exhibition game, and there were actually more New York fans than there was Patriot fans.
You know, I think just not playing in Boston, too, had an effect. You know, the other three teams obviously played in Boston, and they had won championships, and we had not won championships. So you understand why we were, you know, the fourth team in town. And, you know, it's New England. You know, hockey obviously is a very popular sport in New England, and the Red Sox were, you know, an institution, as were the Celtics, who had great success and great players. So we were the kind of redheaded stepchild, so to speak. But that started changing.
You know, we watched the Red Sox go to the World Series '75. We watched the Bruins in the Stanley Cup and the Celtics, and we realized that we can be champions too. It's not that, oh, gee whiz, we're just the stepchild here. We're just the odd man out.
For Steve Nelson, Russ Francis, and the rest of the team, the bandwagon was just getting started. And driving the bus was their hard-nosed, soft-spoken quarterback.
Logan rolls to his right, looking to the end zone, throws, touchdown, Russ Francis! Line drive shot from Steve Grogan.
Great leader. Confident, competitive, very smart. He understood the game and was able to lead the team and call the right plays at the right time.
Hanna had spent the first couple of years of his career protecting Jim Pluckett, but the first overall pick in the 1971 draft took a beating, both physically and mentally, during his five seasons in Foxborough. Injuries sidelined him in 1975, Grogan's rookie season.
I got a whole lot more playing time than I ever expected. I mean, when I came to camp, they said they were only going to keep two quarterbacks, and I was the fourth guy on the depth chart. So Dick Shiner, the older veteran, retired, and Neil Graff started the first game of the season after Plunkett got hurt. Didn't play very well for a couple games, and I got a chance in New York against the Jets and played in the fourth quarter and threw a touchdown to Russ Francis. And the next day they released Graff and activated Plunkett. And then 2 weeks after that, Plunkett got hurt again, so I became the starter, and that really, I had no idea what I was doing. I was having fun. I was playing football. That's what I enjoyed most. But having that half a season as a starter, I think, was a huge contributor to the following season. It kind of boosted my confidence to let me know that I could play at the NFL level.
Grogan calling signals. His backs are split. Grogan quarterback sneak, and he's in. Touchdown. Steve Grogan, a quarterback sneak.
Jim was pretty quiet, as was I. And, you know, the age difference was 4 or 5 years, and he had his veterans that he hung with, and I had my rookies that I hung with, and so we really didn't talk that much. I do remember coming home on the plane after the last game, which I think was in Baltimore. He hadn't really said a whole lot to me the whole season. He walked by and he stopped on the plane and he said, I hope you have better luck than I did.
To be honest, we had the scheme that we ran was probably better suited for Grogan than it was for Jim. Jim had a great arm, was a great quarterback, but he was a little slow-footed, you know what I mean? The reason is we ran 4 and 5 man routes, which basically means that the quarterback's got to get rid of the ball in 3 seconds. You know, Jim just couldn't get back there and sit up and get his reads because, he, you know, like I say, he was a little slow, not mentally, physically slow. I mean, you know, there, we used to laugh when you timed him in a 40, you had to bring a sandwich. But he gets with the Raiders, where they ran 3 and 4 man patterns, gave him 4 seconds to throw the ball, and he won them a Super Bowl.
They're different styles of quarterback. You know, Jim was more of a, you know, the true pocket passer, where Steve was a little more mobile and ran bootlegs and a little more daring and, you know, young. They're different styles. They're both very successful players and both played in Super Bowls and everything else. And in fact, Jim Plunkett, I think, was MVP of a couple of them. But Grogan was a leader.
I think he kind of knew that he was going to go someplace else, and or wanted to go someplace else, and that they would probably be turning it over to me. I didn't have that same feeling. I figured he'd be back. He's the Heisman Trophy winner, and we've got some good young players here, and then the rest is history.
Well, in Grogan, you saw a guy who found all kinds of ways to win. Jim, great guy, great guy, had to throw it to win. Grogan could beat you with his arm and with his legs and with his moxie. Tough guy, you know, a really tough guy. It was quite a difference between the two of them, much like the difference between Brady and Bledsoe. Drew, like Jim Plunkett, was great passer with a great arm, big guy, not as mobile as Grogan was, and Bledsoe was a little bit less mobile than Brady, and Tom was not the most mobile guy in the world, but it was a similar situation in that one guy was the number one pick, and then a guy drafted further down the line, Grogan, who was a fifth-round pick a few years later, took over the job. But you could see the difference in the team.
We were going down the field to do that come-from-behind score to go ahead in the second half, and I think Grogan scrambled out and ran out to the right, and you know, Leon and I felt him start scrambling, so we went downfield, and Dwight White and a couple guys tackled Grogs, and as Grogan was getting up, Dwight White spit on him. Groves was had the cotton mouth and couldn't work up any spit, but he tried like everything just to work up a spit, but couldn't. So he just made the sound like he was spitting at him. And then when he did, you know, Dwight comes after him, and Leon and I kind of step in between. But I think, you know, those kind of things where you have your quarterback fighting like that and not backing down, and then teammates helping each other and defending each other. I mean, that's pretty good.
Grogan calling signals. His backs are split. Grogan, quarterback sneak, and he's in. Touchdown. Steve Grogan, a quarterback sneak.
Came out of those first four games with a lot of confidence and then went to Detroit and got our hats handed to us. But that was a little bit of a wake-up call, too. But opening the year the way we did was pretty special.
After a not entirely unexpected letdown in their Week 5 loss to the Detroit Lions, Grogan and his 3-2 Patriots ready for their close-up. A nationally televised Monday Night Football matchup with the New York Jets.
From Schaefer Stadium, Foxborough, Massachusetts, tonight one of the surprise teams of the young NFL season, the New England Patriots, take on the New York Jets. The Patriots won only 3 games last year. Behind young Steve Grogan at quarterback, they've matched that already, and they're a legitimate contender in the American Conference's Eastern Division.
It was only the third appearance for the Pats in the 6th season of ABC's Game of the Week. It was a big deal to the organization. Pat Sullivan remembers.
Yeah, Monday night was a huge deal because it was not like it is today, where you have Saturday games and you have Thursday games and you have Monday night was appointment football. And it was an appointment football for people all over the country to watch. Here again, here's this young team, not much of a reputation, but they've had a couple of big wins. And to be in front of a national audience, you know, the audiences for Monday Night Football were significantly larger than what they are today. You didn't have the diversions, you know, a lot of different channels for people to watch. That was what people watched. And it was incredible opportunity, and our guys took advantage of it to show the rest of the country that we actually belong.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Howard Cosell. Glad to have you aboard for NFL Monday Night Football here on ABC.
And then the young Patriots went on to state their case emphatically to a national audience.
Grogan calling signal. Grogan to give to Calhoun. Inside the 5, fumbles the ball. Grogan picks it up at the 10, at the 5, and he's in. Touchdown. Grogan back to pass. Now rolls to his left on a bootleg. He's at the 45, at the 40, 35, 30. Grogan to the 25, the 20, the 15, the 10, the 5. A sensational touchdown run.
Steve Brogan, 41 yards. What a beautiful run.
Now, I will tell you this, the 50, 45-yard touchdown I had, whatever it was, the long one, was a broken play. It was supposed to be a Statue of Liberty to Sam Cunningham, and he missed the call, and I dropped back and was ready to hand it to him, and I saw him run into the right flat, so I just peeled around and took it myself, and they never touched me.
Cunningham gets the call inside the 10, inside the 5, inside the end zone. Touchdown, Sam Cunningham. The gift comes to Calhoun inside the 10, inside the 5, and in for a touchdown, Don Calhoun. And the people remaining, not that many, maybe, 15,000, 20,000, giving the Patriots an ovation for their overwhelming victory here tonight over the New York Jets. It was just no contest. The final score at Schaefer Stadium in Foxborough, the New England Patriots 41, the New York Jets 7.
I remember the fact that it was a blowout and that it felt really good to see the team beat somebody badly that they should have beaten badly the way the season was unfolding. This was a good football team, a much better team than the Jets were that year. They should have beaten them badly, and they did. And so that really began to solidify the feeling that, wow, these guys got a potential long way to go.
Gill saw the Pats rush for a team record 330 yards, 103 of them by Grogan, the first quarterback in franchise history to run for more than 100 yards in a game. He even impressed the opposition. Jets linebacker Greg Buttle said after the game that Grogan was crazy to run like he did.
I had not seen that quote, but, it was something I did well. It was part of my game, and I had been a runner my whole football career and never gotten hurt seriously, so that's the way I played the game.
Allowing him to play that game was one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. Anchored on the left side by the man Sports Illustrated would later call the best offensive lineman of all time, John Hanna.
I mean, needless to say, it was quite a compliment, I was flattered. It put a lot of pressure on me, to live up to it. It also put a lot of pressure to the fact that, everybody was trying to gun for you, too. I guess I just kind of went with the idea that, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and all you can do is give it your best and do what you can do and let it go from there.
John Hanna was the most intense football player I've ever been around. When he hit the football field, it was all business, and he was going to be the best at what he did, and he really set a tone for all those guys, not only on the offensive line, but on offense, that, we're not out here to mess around. We're out here to get the job done. And he was just such a great player. And playing next to Leon Gray, who was a great tackle too, we knew we could run to that side anytime we wanted to with those two guys over there.
John is the best football player I played with. Tough, physical, great athlete, smart, but powerful. And he set such a high bar for himself, and his personal expectations were so high. And I think you see that in really great players. I think you see that in like a Larry Bird type, and Ted Williams. They may not get along with everybody. They don't really care to get along with everybody. But in order to be a really great football team, you need guys like that, because they draw everybody up. Their expectations are so high that the guys who, got half a clue look at them and say, I've got to raise my expectations on myself and the team also.
That's the way it is, or it was, when, you hit each other during the week. I mean, you helped each other get better. And I appreciate having those good teammates on defense that helped me get better, because I had to play hard to do well against them.
Full speed every play. I'd get hit harder in practice by him than I would on Sunday, and he didn't care, and he was preparing himself, and he made me a much better football player.
Well, John Hamm was a great, great player and a great guy, too. John was my roommate the first couple of years in the league. I made the team by going up against John Hanna in training camp and stuff like that, being able to handle him early on. Of course, I was trying to make the team, and he was a first-round draft pick. After that, I didn't go against him very much anymore. I was just trying to jump in there being an aggressive rookie. But John is a great guy and is a great, great player. I would say John's probably the best offensive lineman ever to play in the game.
Nose tackle Raymond Hamilton was one of the unlucky guys who felt Hanna's wrath daily in practice. Cornerback Mike Haynes watched it from a somewhat safer distance.
I always laughed because you can always tell when John was going to be pulling, or not when he was going to pull, but when he was pulling, because he was growling, He's growling, man. I can't just really hilarious in a sense, but you know, you knew that he was growling and that he was serious, and he was just a serious player. He really practiced the way he played. You know, he was one of the leaders of the team. He and Leon Gray were just awesome together as a unit.
Mike Haynes mentions Hanna's often overlooked sidekick, but Gray's teammates knew how good he was.
Great player. I think he was just underrated being next to John. When he was there with John, they were the best offensive tackle guard combo in the NFL.
Leon was an interesting guy. He was kind of quiet, kind of a pussycat kind of guy, you know, in the locker room. But when he got on the football field, he did his job, and he and John just complimented each other so well. Leon was a big man, too, and had great feet, and you never had to worry about your left side being protected when he was playing. So just a guy you love to be around.
Leon was so fluid and so quick. You would look at him, you know, and you wouldn't think that he'd be real physical player, but his quickness and his body strength, he became a very physical player. And, you know, being, you know, John and Leon being next to each other, all the combination blocks they'd run, you know, they would stay after practice and run all this stuff. I mean, it didn't happen that these two guys became the best left side in the football. It was because they worked their rear ends off.
You know, Leon and I went to a camp somewhere for kids, and we were demonstrating guard tackle play and how you have to work together. And when we got through, one of the guys that were at camp came over to us and said, I can't, you know, you guys look better than a ballet. He said, I can't believe how you guys dance together. And we spent a lot of time, spent a lot of working together. I don't know of any weaknesses Leon had. I really don't.
Hanna and Gray led the Pats offense to an astronomical 210 yards rushing per game in 1976. That was topped only by the Steelers' 212 yards per game that season, and no team has come close in the 40 years since. That was by design, as Santos points out.
I remember in the winter of 1975, Patriots played the final game of the regular season at Baltimore against the Colts. We had a snowstorm. Game ended, snow's coming down, couldn't get out of Baltimore, couldn't land in Boston. So we stayed an extra night in Baltimore. Gino and I sat down to dinner that night in the hotel with Chuck, with Hank Bulla, and Red Miller. They're great guys to learn football from, and we're talking football, you know. And I remember so vividly Chuck turning to Bulla and Miller and saying, fellas, we could find a way to run the ball, and we could find a way to stop the ball. We got to have an assault and running game, and we got to stop it. Until we do that, we ain't going anywhere.
This is Rough and Justice, the story of the 1976 New England Patriots on 98.5, the Sports Hub.